Welcome to another, actually, it's now a playoff edition of the Hot Hoops podcast. I'm your host, Ernest Christian, alongside, of course, my man, Dave Ramil, one of the writers here at HotHotHoops.com. Dave, what's going on?
Not much, man. Always good to talk with you. Looking forward to an exciting postseason after a great regular season.
It's been a while since you did the podcast. About 3 weeks, maybe?
Probably. Yeah, that seems about right.
Folks probably pissed off, like, where the hell you been? You know? Just saying.
We gotta keep them interested. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Got to tease it out a little bit. That's it.
Yeah, man. But we are in the playoffs now. The Miami Heat are the number 3 seed in the Eastern Conference. They backed into it, really. I mean, Wednesday night's loss to Boston. I'm sure people were a little bit let's just say worried, because I mean there was a priority I would say for this team if not the 3 seed, at least get home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs. They still get that by virtue of the Hawks losing to the Wizards without John Wall, by the way, which I found very strange. Very strange, Dave.
That he wasn't playing?
John Wall didn't play against the Hawks.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
And they still won.
Well, you know. The fact that he didn't play and they won is, bizarre. I guess you just never know with the last few games of the season. We've seen a lot of spoilers here and there. I mean. It worked out better for Miami. I think that's all the fans really care about.
Right. And we'll get to the matchup to the Hornets and the Heat first round matchup, which starts Sunday, 6:30 tip off on TNT, I believe. TNT is this show on game one. And we'll get to that in a second. But let's first review the season. The Heat finished 48-34, number 3 in the East, albeit numbers 3 through 6 all have the same record. There's really not much of a gap between, you know, how well Miami did versus Boston versus Atlanta versus Charlotte. So, but give me your thoughts on the season, Dave. What would you grade this season for the Miami Heat?
I think you'd give it a B+. I think not quite an A, because, you know, you'd like for them to have wound up with a better record. And I think, as you pointed out, the Boston loss certainly leaves a bad taste in your mouth, because they were just, for them to have collapsed as completely as they did, to lose a 26-point lead, and then to score only 5 points, a franchise low. You know, they really picked apart what Miami did in the first half, and they completely, you know, disassembled us right there on national television. So it's pretty disturbing to see that. But overall, I think the season, the way it's progressed, to have lost arguably your best player in Chris Bosh, one of your certainly your most versatile player, if anything, and to be able to bounce back, to be able to bring up two rookie players, insert them into the rotation and get them to play as consistently as they did. Hassan Whiteside, for him to play as excellently over the course of the season, he really turned it around there, certainly in the second half after the All-Star break. To include Joe Johnson, all the little things that built, you know, took place over the course of the year, very exciting, I think. It shows a lot of what Eric Spoelstra can do, the kind of grip he has in his team, the culture in place. You've talked about it a number of times, but I think it was evidenced clearly this season.
I'm going to tell Heat Twitter right now, loves this podcast. I appreciate support and downloads and stuff. But we are a pro Spoelstra panel here. This for the record. Okay? So you don't like it, tough tuckus. I'm just saying. We are a very pro Spoelstra. I'm definitely a pro Spoelstra guy. I get sick and tired of some of you guys. You know, when the Heat do well, you hear nothing about Spoelstra. It's not Spoelstra. It's other things that happen. When the Heat fail, or, you know, what happened on Wednesday against Boston, oh, it's Spoelstra's fault. Blame Spo. Fire Spo. By the way, firespot.com still up. You know that, right? That firespot.com site that came out like 6 years ago?
Never gone. Seen it. I just don't know what the criticism is. I mean, does he maybe miss a couple of in-game adjustments? Yeah, sure. What coach doesn't? I mean, no coach has a perfect pulse on their team. Maybe Popovich has as close as it is. And I know there's a lot of buzz about other great coaches, Terry Stotts, Brad Stevens, even Mike Budenholzer in Atlanta. Sure, those are all great coaches. But I think Spoelstra certainly has to be taken into consideration. I think he's done a great job of getting this team, keeping them focused. Maybe you can say a lot of that has to do with a veteran presence, but you know what? There are other teams with a great veteran presence, and they're not nearly as effective or consistent as Miami is. So I think you have to give a lot of that credit to Spoelstra. And, you know, like you said, we are definitely a pro Spoelstra podcast.
Hell yeah. And that was not paid for by the Miami Heat or its constituents, but it's for the record.
I wish.
But like I said, I also say B+, too. And I think the game against Boston on Wednesday was actually maybe an opposite in terms of the way it played out, but was kind of like a perfect representation of this season for the Miami Heat. Whereas, you know, you had a team before the All-Star break that was trying to figure it out, was very slow, mismatched. The roster didn't seem to fit between, you know, Dragic and Wade in the backcourt figuring things out, and, you know, how to get Whiteside more involved, and all the things that surround this team. You lose games to Minnesota, who, by the way, looked better at the end of the year, but for the record. Lose against Minnesota. Lose against the Brooklyn at home. Minnesota at home. You lose to, you know, games against teams that you shouldn't lose to. You know, later on in the year, the Lakers, and of course the Magic a week ago.
Right.
But then you have wins against the Cavs, and you're competitive with the Warriors, you know, and whatnot. So that game against Boston on Wednesday was a perfect analogy of what the season was. And yes, if there's really a tale of two seasons for the Miami Heat. If I had told you the All-Star break, you know, when they were sitting at, I can't remember the record was, but there were only four games over 500 at that time. And I believe they're like the sixth seed in the Eastern Conference at that time. If I had told you at the All-Star break, grade the season at that point, I would have said a C. Maybe even C minus. You know, because I thought they would be a team that would, and by the way, I said they win 47 games this year, and then they were in the pocket pretty much around that. I thought that they underachieved in the first half of the year. And then you find out you lose Chris Bosh for the same reason you lost him last year. It hasn't played since. You come out the All-Star break against Atlanta. You don't have Dwayne Wade out the gate. And that becomes your most impressive win of the season. I guess the Hawks team at that time was desperate for a win. And then see how everything played out for the rest of the season with the emergence of Josh Richardson, you know, Hassan Whiteside on the bench earning his way back into the starting lineup with Miami. You know, we get Joe Johnson, you know, and that game was really a true example of what this season has been for the Miami Heat, really.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. They were inconsistent there, you know, and I think that's part of the frustration is that they weren't nearly as dominant as you would have expected them to be. And I don't know quite what the reason was. I think that just, you know, they're trying to incorporate a pretty brand new roster. Sure, there are some holdovers there, but they did undergo changes. They made some trades. They brought in Joe Johnson, you know, and the loss of Chris Bosh, you can't underestimate the kind of impact. Who knows? Maybe a couple losses over the second half of the season wouldn't have happened had they been able to include Chris Bosh, but you never know, because then maybe Joe Johnson wouldn't have played as effectively as he did, or Luol Deng wouldn't have gotten the opportunity to shine at the four spot. So having said that, all the different changes that took place, the team weathered them, and they look like a strong contender. And they are where they're supposed to be, the third seed. I mean, you couldn't have expected anything more out of them, considering, you know, the strength of Toronto throughout the year, how Cleveland was assembled, and the kind of talent they have on that roster. To wind up with a third seed in the Eastern Conference, a pretty tough Eastern Conference.
Yes.
I think that's a great place for them to be, and certainly puts them in the catbird seat as far as moving forward. I think that's great.
Let's start with some of the positive this year that happened for the Heat. Mm-hmm. And let's start with the franchise, the future Hall of Famer, the third best shooting guard in NBA history, Dwayne Wade. You know, coming to the season, we heard Pat Riley change the narrative. That was the whole thing. Wade's had a one-year, $20 million contract this year. He wants to get more money on the back end this summer, of course. And, you know, he came in. There'll be no maintenance program. I'm not going to sit back-to-backs. That was something that was a no-no to be brought up in press conferences and with you know, after games and whatnot. And Dwayne Wade played 74 of 82 games this year. I was very impressed with Dwayne Wade this year. He had a phenomenal season, 20 points a game, did his job. I mean, yeah, there are moments where Dwayne Wade maybe had two, three games this year where he didn't play well. And there are other games where there's too much hero ball going on. But overall, based on the roster and based on what the Miami Heat needed of him, once again, the franchise stepped up to the plate.
Yeah, I checked it out earlier. He actually scored 22.5 points per game per 36 minutes. So if he had maintained a 36-minute per game average, he would have scored around 22.5. That goes back to his second year in the league. That's over what he scored his second year in the league when he was at full strength, healthy, younger Wade. So I think, you know, obviously his demise has been overstated. Clearly he's still an effective player. I think part of the problem is that we saw, especially in the post-All-Star break when they were turning the ball more to Gore on Dragic to initiate the offense, we saw a much quicker pace, and Wade is still a little bit too slow for my liking and for a lot of, I think, Heat fans. And that's part of the problem is that, you know, we see him sometimes and he slows it down, but, you know, that's just who he is. Maybe he's stubbornly hanging on to a style of play, but it's gotten him to this point. It's been very effective. He's thrives in the half court offense. He knows how to slip through cracks in the defense. He knows how to finish strongly at the rim. He's still going to be as effective a player as he's ever been. Maybe he's not going to be shooting at a high rate anymore throughout the rest of his career, but I think he's still a very good player, and I think he's still the best main player for Miami moving forward. I mean, he's going to make all the difference in the playoffs.
I imagine he'll be back here next year and beyond. He'll end his career here. I mean, obviously he'll be a free. He's going to be a free agent this summer, but I mean, he's already set on the record. He doesn't foresee this seeing last year what happened last year be repeated this year. This coming July, that he'll have a new contract in tow before anything even comes an issue. You don't see anything changing in that, right?
No, I think he'll stay here. I think he's already said, I went through it last summer. I don't want to do this again. I think he'll probably take less money. He'll probably be, a factor in their salary cap issues moving forward. But I think he's still going to be a part of the Heat organization. I don't see him going anywhere.
Right. Another positive this year for the Miami Heat, of course. And we came to the year this year saying that this guy, let's see where this goes. Hassan Whiteside, once again, phenomenal year. A Defensive Player of the Year candidate. In the league. What are your thoughts on Whiteside? I know we've had some contention on Whiteside a little bit this season, you and I, on some of our written work we've done, and certainly on this podcast, about whether he can be a future, is he a guy that fits this culture in Miami? What are your thoughts on Whiteside now as we approach now the playoffs?
I don't know. It's tough to gauge with him because I think he's done everything he possibly could to play effectively. He still has moments of weaknesses, where he's lagging a little bit on defense. Obviously he still gets his blocks, he puts up those big numbers, but there are still moments there where he doesn't respond as quickly as I'd like him to. I think overall, though, he's been great. He's been a much better citizen this year than he has in the past. We're using a small career sample size there. Really only played for 1.5 years at this point. He's played all of this season minus the suspension and a couple games that he missed due to injury, but overall the numbers are excellent. He took the demotion to a bench role very well. But we're seeing from him now in the starting lineup when he was just inserted back into the starting rotation a few games ago by Spoelstra, and that's kind of changed the dynamic a little bit. I kind of like the way the team was playing with Stoudemire in there, so I'm not sure how they'll move forward in the playoffs, but overall, I'd say Whiteside's done great. I think he's met and exceeded any expectations I had for him, and I'm still not convinced that he's part of the team moving forward, but as far as this season is concerned, I'd have to give him a high grade for it.
Has the percentage actually increased since the All-Star break in terms of the chance of him staying in Miami?
I don't think so. Yeah, because regardless, he was always going to put up big numbers because, it's either auditioning for 29 other teams or because he just wants to make the most out of this opportunity, even if he gets paid by Miami. But I just don't think Miami sees him as a future building block. I don't think they're going to throw the kind of money that he's expected to command at him. So that's always been my point of contention with him. I think he's not going to get paid what he's going to collect from somebody. Somebody's going to throw 18 to 20 million at him, and it's not going to be Miami.
Because we heard Pat Riley at the Heat Family Fest last month say that he definitely, he hinted at the idea of him staying long term. And I'm sure Miami will let the market create whatever value he has, and then Miami coming after and figuring out okay what the numbers are. Remember, they have this; they have the no state tax, all that advantage they have over other teams that may offer him a contract. But it'd be interesting to see because I think as great as he was this year, he was phenomenal, double double, obviously Defensive Player of the Year candidate, all that. I think this series and moving forward in the playoffs will define Hassan Whiteside in his future. I think the playoffs will define what his true value, really.
Two things. I actually spoke to somebody who handles taxes now because as I was just filing my own, I brought this up. They mentioned that the whole thing about not paying state taxes here is fine, but that they still wind up paying the taxes of wherever they're playing at. Even though they're collecting a paycheck from a Florida-based organization, the Miami Heat, right. When they play away games, they still pay taxes on those because they're performing their function there in those states. So the idea that players get more money by playing in Florida, not necessarily the truth. And I think that's just something that's kind of overblown by the media. I didn't know about that.
I actually heard that too. I actually heard that also, that if you play in New York, you get taxed for the game check you play in New York. You play, right. Yeah, I heard that too. But I guess he's still the advantage. Even and maybe it's not so much a big advantage as it is as we thought on the surface now because right. You mentioned that, but at least playing 41 games in Miami gives you a little bit of a less of a hit than anybody else would playing in, say, let's just say Carmelo Anthony's paying more taxes than Dwayne Wade.
Sure,
pretty early.
absolutely,
You know what I'm saying?
absolutely.
So that's
And then
that.
as far as how he'll do in the playoffs, we've never seen an itineration of an iteration rather of Whiteside in the playoffs. So clearly he's been he's been coached up by Spoelstra, but also by the veterans on the team. You got guys like Wade, Joe Johnson, Udonis Haslem, Alonzo. All these guys are probably in Whiteside's ear, telling him how to prepare. You know, it's not about the sprint, but rather the marathon of it. You know, you've gone through the 82 game grind, but now you're in a condensed 7-game series, and how you respond to that, it's going to be very interesting to see how he bounces back, how he shows whether or not he's a part of the team moving forward, whether or not he's flexible enough to guard. You know, they have two very different styles of center there. I know we're going to save our playoff preview for later, but Charlotte has a very interesting back front court there with Cody Zeller, who's, he dives to the rim. He's quick. He runs a lot. And then you've got the slow, post monster in Al Jefferson. So, that's a really interesting, matchup there for Whiteside, both of those. I'm not sure where he'll be more effective. On the surface, you think that maybe he'll be able to handle Zeller a little bit better because of his overall quickness. But I don't know. Jefferson could get him into foul trouble too. So, I mean, it's a tough one to see whether or not Whiteside is going to be able to respond to that.
Right, absolutely. And of course, the third thing that I want to touch on the season is, of course, as they call them, Rook One and Rook Two, the emergence of the rookies, Justice Winslow and Josh Richardson. I mean, this is all you asked for, and I think let's just say the Miami Heat got more than they bargained for in terms of these guys making impacts this season on this team.
Without a doubt. I mean, you look at a team like Miami, you and I have watched the team for years, and ever since the Pat Riley era began in 95, the value of the draft has been lower and lower than other teams out there. They've never really thought about building through the draft. They've gotten very lucky with guys like Wade and others, but for the most part, they really, are known as a team that brings in free agents or makes big trades to acquire the key pieces of their roster. Having said that, you look at the two guys that they drafted here, and they've immediately made an impact. It's a bright future moving forward. You've got other young pieces like Tyler Johnson and Whiteside, should you be able to re-sign them. And it looks like a very good young core moving forward. But the Rooks One and Two have been phenomenal. Their ability to contribute, on offense and on defense has been exceptional. Richardson's, shooting over the last couple months has been phenomenal. You can't ask for any more. I got lucky enough to be able to talk to him in person in the locker room a couple of weeks ago, and he was just a great kid. Really felt blessed to be here in the league and to be, having this opportunity as a rookie to go into the playoffs and to be part of this veteran team. He was really appreciative. So he's a great kid, and I wish him nothing but the best moving forward.
What do you think his ceiling is for Richardson? Can you see him as a starting point guard in this league?
No, I think he's more of a two guard, to be honest with you. I think he's improved his ball handling, but between his overall length, his defensive tenacity, and I think his obviously his improved scoring touch. You can see him right now. He needs to be able to get a little bit better off the dribble. I'd say he's very good at making those cuts because of his explosive speed, and diving to the hoop. We've seen a number of highlight level dunks from him, and of course the 3-point shooting has been phenomenal. But I'm not sure if he has the playmaking ability of a point guard at this point. So, no pun intended there. But I think his future is probably more of a two guard. I could see him taking over for Wade in the future.
And it's funny because I looked at Winslow coming of the year, and we all thought Winslow would be. I mean, obviously he was what he was for the most part. We thought he was. Maybe the offensive game isn't polished yet, but we have a long way to go with that. But defensively, to see that kid at 19 years old have the body he has and defensively already lock in and give guys even like LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony their own. I mean, at least being there and taking the challenge. Both these guys, but especially Winslow, fits this Heat culture.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. John Barry isn't exactly a popular figure in South Florida, but he was saying during the Heat Celtics matchup how he gets to where he needs to be. He makes incredible winning plays, and we saw it almost immediately afterwards where he came from the baseline, swooped in there on the elbow, caught a rebound, and was able to keep a possession alive. He just does those little things. And you're right, it's mostly on the defensive end, although that was on an offensive possession. But he's very mature. He has a high basketball IQ. He knows what to do. And I think eventually, hopefully, the scoring will be there because, he's even seen some progress. I think he's been shooting better over the last few weeks of the season. He's not nearly as bad as he was when he first started off there, and hopefully that range will continue to expand.
Because a lot of the comparisons you see about Justice Winslow is to Bruce Bowen. You guys remember Bruce Bowen as a Spur, but remember, his career started in Miami, and he wasn't necessarily a great shooter either, but was a defensive stalwart. But eventually, it got to a point where he actually had a little bit of a three-point shot, to the point where he actually was kind of dangerous at times.
So, yeah, he was deadly from the corners, especially in San Antonio.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, you look at a situation where with Winslow, I mean, and he's younger, and he's also, you know, he has a little more polished, obviously. I guess more athletic, obviously, than Bruce Bowen. I guess we can all agree to that. There's definitely some room for growth there for Winslow. I can see a point in about 3 or 4 years where he's not no Steph Curry, obviously. He's not some, you know, specialist, but he's definitely a guy that can have a consistent mid-range to outside jump shot.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think, you know, a lot of fans, I think, were hoping he would become, you know, because of his incredible defense, that he might become a Kawhi Leonard type. But Leonard was already a good shooter, a better shooter than Winslow when he first entered the league.
True.
And he, it was a little bit broken, but he was able to tweak his shooting mechanism and become, you know, a dead-eye shooter at this point. So I think that's way too high of a ceiling for Winslow. Even if he's just a shade lower than that, though, he's still going to be a great player. And at this point, he's still, you know, he's just effective at this point. As a rookie, that's all you can hope for. And I think there is, like you said, room for growth. And hopefully he'll do that here in Miami.
It is worth noting, statistically, the worst shooter in NBA history by virtue of the volume is Dwayne Wade. And, yeah, he's had a pretty good career for himself.
Yeah, I mean, he's gotten even worse in that regard, though. You see, I wrote about this earlier because – you know, there's almost like a stubbornness there. When the league relies more on 3-point shooting, somehow a terrible career shooter like Wade has managed to get even worse. He's shooting 16% from 3-point range. I know it's limited attempts, but I just don't know.
You know those are the numbers that Michael Jordan put up in his first 4 years in the league.
16%.
Yes. Look. I did numbers. I did a.
But it's a different era, though.
I agree. It's just weird because like I've seen Dwayne Wade make that shot, you know, once in a blue moon. And like, to me, he shouldn't be this bad from three. I'm sorry. It bothers me. It bothers me. And it's bothered me for years. How this guy, and look, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. He'll be a Hall of Famer, obviously. He's a top 3 or 4 shooting guard of all time. But just the idea that he's such a bad shooter from that range, it's weird to me.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. It's like he's within 20 feet, he's fine, steps out to 23, and all of a sudden he's a mess. I just don't quite understand.
But he has one of the best mid-range games I've ever seen played his game.
Absolutely.
Seriously.
I mean, he's got the bank shot dropping. He's got everything. I mean, the step back, he's incredible. So, I think it's past the point now where you could say, oh, that's the next step in his game in order to maintain, you know, being relevant or whatever. But no, I think he's done. He's comfortable with who he is. He doesn't want to change, and he's still effective for the most part. So, I mean, let's just take him for what he is and hope that he can continue to contribute.
Exactly. All right, let's get to it now. It's time for the series preview. Once again, the Miami Heat play the Charlotte Hornets starting this Sunday, which, by the way, I'm really excited about this series. Two reasons. One for me, first off, being a longtime Heat fan, I don't mean to brag, of course, but this was their first rival, you know. The Heat Hornets came to the league the same year, although it isn't the same franchise, obviously. I mean, in terms of, you know, remember the real Hornets are in New Orleans, really. But, you know, I've always had a bit of a hatred for the Hornets anyway, personally, because, you know, that was the first rival, you know, because the Hornets had the veteran team they built around, and Miami opted to go with the younger players in Cycli and Rice and that. And that was a little bit of a rivalry back then. So my Hornets hatred built up from that. Plus, I got pissed off that I lost Glenn Rice to Charlotte, even though we got Lonzo Mourning, but still, whatever. Anyway, that being said, a lot of pundits, including myself, are saying this, if based on the seedings, upset probabilities, highest one will be this series, and I agree, 100%.
Well, I mean, you know, are you discounting the 4-5 matchup between Atlanta and Boston?
That's about even.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess so. But as far as like the possibility of a quote unquote upset, I know it's just not much of a difference there. But I think Atlanta at the 4 seed could very easily get upset by Boston. But having said that, I see what you're saying. I mean, they're very contrasting styles, Miami and Charlotte. Charlotte, you know, head coach Steve Clifford has turned his team around through free agency, through trades. They've built this core now that's very perimeter based. They're very good 3-point shooters. Miami, not so much. They're one of the worst 3-point shooting three-point shooting teams in the league, and most of their points are at the rim. So
Also worth noting, they did get better at the second half of the year thanks to Joe Johnson and Josh Richardson. That's worth noting that though.
yeah, they're better, but they're still really bad.
Go ahead,
They're
man.
still really bad. I mean, look, Charlotte, I did some of the, I looked at some of the numbers here. They're fourth overall in attempts. The only three teams above them are Golden State, Houston, and Cleveland. All those teams obviously live and die by the three-pointer. So the fact that, Charlotte has shot almost as many attempts as those three teams should be very alarming for a team like Miami. Now, Miami is very good defensively with a three-pointer. They don't give up a lot of I mean, some of the corner threes they give up, those are, absolutely a part of today's game. But as far as games from the elbow, they're very, very good at that. So it's an interesting, mix of styles there, and I think you're going to see some good defense. Miami is very good defensively. Charlotte is also very good defensively. So it's there's a lot to look forward to in this series. I don't know if an upset's in the making or not. I've seen a lot of people predict Charlotte in seven, which is mind-boggling because home court advantage, as important as it is the full reason why we played as the kind of style that we did over the last few weeks. We didn't rest anybody. We've got the home court advantage, and now that we have it, I don't see this team with the veteran core that it has losing a game seven in Miami.
Well, that's the thing. I don't see it either. And most, even though I said that most, I said probabilities, that doesn't mean it's going to happen because the home court advantage is the reason why I think Miami will still win the series in seven games. But I see it going seven games because we've seen so much of the inconsistent Miami Heat team where, look at the Boston game. How the hell you up? How the heck are you up 26 points in the first half in a game you need to pretty much lock up everything? There would have been no with help with other team. The Heat win against Boston. They're a the three seed. Period. End discussion. And you're up 26 points. Okay, you're rolling in Boston, which today is still one of the hardest places to play in the league. Okay, and then not only do you lose to the Celtics, you lose by 10 points. 10
Yeah,
points, Dave.
after scoring a franchise low 5 points in the third quarter.
Dave, I texted you after that game. I was so pissed off. After knowing we still got the three seed because Atlanta, because I was watching the Atlanta game too on League Pass. But still, I was still pissed off.
Yeah, I don't know if maybe ultimately the players didn't think it was that important if it was just one more game. But yeah, squandering the lead is worse than anything else because, maybe Boston was just playing that bad in the first half and
Yeah,
Miami
it's a little
wasn't
bit of that too.
necessarily playing that good. And then all of a sudden Boston was able to turn it up a notch. They're known for being able to inject a certain higher energy level in the third quarter. So I got to be honest with you, Miami has struggled with third quarters in the past, so that's not a good matchup
Yeah,
there.
it reminded me of the Kings game a couple weeks ago too. I mean, I was surprised
Right.
because even when they were up big, I was saying to myself, "Well, yeah, it's up big," but I remember 2 weeks ago in Sacramento without DeMarcus Cousins, the Kings almost had Miami on an 0-3 road trip. So let's not get too cocky here either. And the rest is history, of course.
Look, Boston's a good team. I mean,
A
not to
very
take
good
anything
team.
away, not to take anything away from them, the way they built up, the depth they have. They're dangerous, and they would have been a matchup nightmare for Miami in the playoffs. So, in a way, it's probably better, although maybe not by much, that they're facing Charlotte. It's still a very tough matchup for them. But I'm glad we're not facing Boston. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to approach this series because there's so much going on there. I like Miami's depth. I like their experience in the playoffs. I like the veteran core they have. While Charlotte doesn't necessarily have those things, they're not necessarily as deep. They don't have the kind of veteran presence that Miami does. Steve Clifford's a very good coach. He has them very focused on. They do what they do very well. They're not exceptional, maybe, but what they do, really, really well. And they don't turn the ball over much. They play tight defense. And Miami, will not be able to capitalize on turnovers and lead to easy offense. So that part of their game, a strength of Miami's all season long, that's not going to be there in the playoffs. So it's interesting to see. And then how these teams evolve over the series. That's going to be a key component for both of them. And I think that's where you give the nod to a guy like Spoelstra, who's been able to make adjustments, not just in games, but over the course of a series. So we'll see how this team comes out on Sunday and whether or not they're flat, whether or not they've been able to move past the Boston loss and maybe even take that as a positive. I was talking to somebody about that yesterday, and they pointed out that so long as you're able to say, you know what, we really stunk up that game, But it's a learning opportunity. Let's tweak what we need to. Let's move forward and use that as a launch pad for them to tighten up whatever it is that they do well. So hopefully that's the approach to Sunday's game.
What matchup worries you in this series for Miami?
So many. I think the Kemba Walker Goran Dragic one is going to be an interesting one. I think both of them are going to get their points. I think I saw earlier today that in wins, Goran was much more effective. He had 15 assists in both of Miami's wins over Charlotte and just 10 in their losses. So he needs to be able to be active. Kemba Walker is not a very good defender. So Goran's still going to get his points. He's still going to be able to drive past him to the rim. And the problem then becomes defensively how we handle Kemba Walker. His speed, he's going to get past Goran Dragic. That's for sure. So how Miami is able to close on him without giving up an easy basket, that'll be the interesting one. So I think if Kemba drives to the hoop, gets past Dragic, who picks him up? Is it going to be Whiteside? Is it going to be Deng? Or is it going to be Amar'e Stoudemire if he's reinserted into the starting lineup? Is that going to lead to an easy bucket for Zeller then, who's going to all of a sudden be open and available at the rim? So that's going to be a tough one. But for me, the matchup I talked about yesterday that I think is most interesting is Luol Deng and Marvin Williams. I think they're pretty evenly matched. Williams is long. He plays the power forward spot now. He's an excellent three-point shooter. And I think it's going to be an interesting one because Deng then is going to be a little bit out of his element. He's not going to be cutting to the hoop as much. He's not going to be able to just get past a guy like Williams because he has enough speed to match up with him. So we've really needed the kind of production that we've gotten from Deng in recent victories. So I think that's going to be a key thing for Miami moving forward. They're going to need to get that 15-8 from Deng that they've gone over or a couple games this season. And if Williams is there, able to keep pace with him, that might not be as easy as we had expected it to be.
That said, are you happy with the matchup? Like you said, Boston scared you. Of the three teams that the Miami Heat were actually positioning against in terms of best seeding, which they got, by the way, they got the best seed possible based on what they were trying to do. Boston, Charlotte, Atlanta. Was this the matchup you wanted?
I don't know. I don't know that any of the other teams would have been any better. I think Atlanta probably lacks a certain amount of depth, and even though they've had her number at times, I think that probably would have been a little bit easier. Although, they still have some excellent perimeter shooting. They also have some, quality front court play there. So I think that probably would have been the easiest matchup for us.
Interesting. Interesting way of looking at it. All right. So I have Heat in seven. What do you have?
I'm not making a prediction.
Oh, come on. Well, Dave, why do you do that for?
No, sorry, man. I'm not doing it. I've gone on record and made
Look,
predictions
if
in the
you
past.
think Charles gonna sweep him to say it. The Heat Twitter won't kill you. By the way, he's DRamil13 on Twitter. Oh, man. You're not gonna say it?
No.
Damn it.
Sorry, man.
But
I think Miami has a very good shot at moving forward in the playoffs. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Oh, he's so you should get in politics, man. Seriously.
No, I've got a face made for radio, so no way.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Oh, Lord. Okay. All right, but you will predict these other seven series with me, though.
Sure, I got
Okay.
nothing emotionally
Okay.
invested in those at all.
Let's start here first. The Cavs and Pistons, 1-8. Pistons getting to the playoffs for the first time in 6 years. Cleveland Cavaliers trying to get back to the NBA Finals for the second straight year. LeBron and company and the instability of that roster and all that. What do you see going on here? Give me a prediction on that series.
Cavs sweep.
Sweep, really? I have Captain Five.
Yeah, I think that's it's you count on Van Gundy to be able to make some adjustments there, but I've seen that team a lot lately, and I'm not very convinced that they have the emotional fortitude to be able to handle a LeBron-led team. Look, they don't care about the regular season. We saw it for 4 years here in Miami. It's a different animal once the playoffs begin. He's going to have that team engaged and ready. They're at full strength, even though Matthew Dellavedova is starting over Kyrie
Telly.
Irving. I mean, that's just, I mean, I wrote a great piece about him. I don't know if you saw it. Not
No, you don't.
to, yeah, not to toot my own horn.
You've been slack. No, toot it, number one. But you've been slacking on. Let me know what pieces you've been writing.
I'm sorry,
You've been
man. I haven't
slacking. I mean,
sent them to
listen.
direct.
You write. First of all, you should have your own website, number one, okay? And have like all your links to places because you work for, like, you write what 19 places now, 20?
Something like that. Yeah, 19, 20.
So you don't tell me nothing.
All right. Well, it's a pinned tweet on my Twitter handle if you want to go check it out. So
Okay.
it's right there for it.
Once again, DRMill13 on Twitter. All right, 2-7 in the East. The Toronto Raptors and the Indiana Pacers. Remember, we've been having a discussion on this podcast quite a few times about the Raptors. And look, I think they're a great team. I think they can make some noise. But until they actually do it, it will always be a hindsight thing for me. That said, I'm going to go Raptors in 6.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people think that because of the, the dangerous unknown quotient that is Monte Ellis, that they have a better chance. I think also the fact that Paul George is arguably the best player in the series, that could make a difference. But I still like Toronto's depth, and I think the fact that they have home court advantage, even though that hasn't necessarily been a factor in the past, as I've told you all year long, I think this is a different version of this Toronto team. I think they'll be able to move fast.
Just show me.
You will. Although You'll see it.
It is worth noting, though, that the best player on the court will be on Indiana in Paul George.
Yeah, that's what I said. I mean, I agree with that. And I know that's a lot of old heads say that's the case, that as long as you have the best player on the floor, you've got a chance. Maybe things get a little tighter. Maybe he'll get a lot of the benefit of foul calls. But I still like Toronto's team overall. I think they will move on. I think Toronto in 6 is pretty fair. I might get them in 5, to be honest with you.
All right, the 4-5 matchup. Okay, the 4-5 matchup, of course, the Boston Celtics and the Atlanta Hawks. This is a very intriguing matchup, to be honest with you. I'm looking forward to this matchup more than anything else in the East, outside Miami, of course. I don't know where to go with this one, man. I think based on moxie, based on toughness, like you want it on paper, Atlanta should be better than Boston. But
yeah.
Good God, Boston's tough, man. And by the way, President Brad Stevens, man. If there wasn't a pop bitch on Steve Kerr this year, he'd be the coach of the year. Period.
Yeah. Yeah, I like them too. I think Celtics in 6, to be honest with you. Despite the depth, I think that's going to be the nail in the coffin for Al Horford's career in Atlanta. I think that'll drive him out. I don't think Boston gives a damn, to be honest with you. I think they're going to go in there, punch him in the mouth.
That's the advantage.
Yeah, they don't care enough. I mean, guys like Jay Crowder, Isaiah Thomas with his chip on his shoulder, Marcus Smart, even Olynyk, those guys, they really don't care. I think they're confident in what they can do well. I think that last win is going to help them immensely. They're going to feel pretty good about themselves, and I think they're going to go in there and beat Atlanta. I definitely see that. I think they're going to be dangerous.
Yeah, me too. I have Boston in 7. I think that will go to limit as well. I think that will have a game on the old parquet in Boston. I just think that's a great setup. And like I said, they don't give a damn. The Celtics are one of those teams where they have a chip on the shoulder. Brad Stevens has those guys playing at a high level. You saw it on Wednesday. Down 26, win by 10 against a team that was trying to clinch a 3 seed. I mean, that's something to build on. And just not for nothing, this Celtic team is a monster in waiting because they have a lot of draft picks coming up and they got a lot of pieces. This team could be a problem, a bigger problem. They're already a problem now. They could be a bigger problem in about 2 or 3 years.
I would never have guessed this at the start of the season, but looking at the way I thought that last year's performance getting to the playoffs might have been a bit of an aberration. They've gotten better with the addition of Isaiah Thomas. I think he's been, he's played at an all-star level. And I think they're a serious contender to lure Kevin Durant. I'd put Miami just a shade below Boston, but I think Boston with the addition of Durant would be incredible. So I think that's a legitimate possibility.
Ooh, they revealed the hot take. Durant to Boston?
Why not?
Whoa.
Why not?
Hey,
I mean,
now.
It's a storied franchise. He probably appreciates the things that Stevens can do for his game. I think he wants to be able to restore glory somewhere and be appreciated the way he saw Kevin Durant do it. I mean, Kevin Garnett do it in the early aughts. I think that's a great opportunity for him. And they've got a great team already in place that can only get better through the draft or through free agency. So why not?
And they got a lot of picks to use.
An yeah.
Angle, by the way, I actually had DeMarcus Cousins going to Boston.
Via trade?
Via trade, I guess, because he has 3 years of contract. But,
well, that's assuming that somebody in Sacramento knows what the hell they're doing, though.
They don't,
right?
But you already know this, though.
Yeah, that's why they couldn't acquire him is because they would need somebody on the other end to say, sure, we'd give up Cousins for blank, a couple key pieces like throwing Jay Crowder and a couple first round picks, and you can get we can pry Boogie off our hands. But somebody over there would have to know what they're doing. They're not even going to answer the phone call probably. So I'm not very confident that they'll be able to make a quality move like that.
I'm gonna give you a second chance here, man. Heat, Hornets, who you got?
Nothing. I have an interest in seeing Miami win. That's it.
Yeah.
You're not gonna get me on that one, brother.
All righty. You lean Heat, okay? I mean, we get it. You lean Heat. Okay, so the Western Conference quickly. 1-8, the Golden State Warriors, who just won 73 games. Quickly, your thoughts on that, on them going 73-9. I am happy for them, number one. I already sound record. If the Heat, and also don't forget the Heat, I'm okay with them winning another title. You also know I have a burning hatred for the Chicago Bulls for years. You're talking about Jordan years, especially Jordan years, especially. So to see that record come crashing down, it was the hate in my heart was beautiful. So
I mean,
I love that. What do you think?
I've been I was a long time Bulls fan early on during the Jordan era. I think it was partly the reason why I started watching basketball was because of the overall magnificence of Michael Jordan. So I really appreciated what they did there. That 72-10 season was amazing. And you know what? I'm not disappointed at all that the record was broken. I know that the style of basketball is different, but this Golden State team is great, historically good. And I think we can appreciate what they did just as much as we can appreciate what Michael and those Bulls did. So I'm fine with the record, and I think that they're going to sweep the series.
Me too. I think. By the way, I hope they do. Let's just say for the record, I'm not the biggest James Harden fan. I recognize he's a very talented guy. He's probably a top 10 player in the league, but he's a me guy, and I've been very vocal about my annoyance of James Harden, that damn beard. And I hope they get embarrassed in the first round of the playoffs. This is the record.
Yeah. I agree there.
Okay, 2-7, San Antonio, Memphis. By the way, Memphis was the 5 seed before these injuries came up and then fell 7. San Antonio, Memphis, come on, really? Do you have to bother? I mean, they're a D-League. Right now, they're a D-League team.
It's not fair that they've limped into the playoffs the way they have, that they've been able to string the victories that they have. And in order to still stay in playoff contention, it's amazing. I think we have to tip our hat to Dave Joger.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say that. Thank you for mentioning that.
You know, he's done a great job, and the guys that they've had there have been really working their ass off. So, I mean, again, you know, Chris Anderson, God bless him. I loved his time in Miami. I love what he's doing over there. But, I mean, this San Antonio team, if not for how great Golden State has been, we'd be talking about how incredible San Antonio is. I mean, they get plenty of publicity and deservedly so, but they are very, very, very good, maybe even better than this Golden State team. So there's no chance for Memphis to win a game there. I think there's going to be another sweep.
And to think that Dave Joger actually was actually rumored to be fired at the end of the year. I think this, what he's done this down the stretcher without his best players, should save his job. Why his job is online is beyond me.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard him linked to, you know, Minnesota in the past. I think he's a strong candidate to coach other places as well. If they decide to retain him in Memphis, you know, I think he's got a good chance of moving forward and taking, you know, Marc Gasol and Mike Conley, should he re-sign there. I think that's a good, strong team. You know, maybe they're a little limited in what they can do, but they're going to be perpetual playoff contenders.
All right. 3-6, OKC and Dallas.
Yeah. I
intriguing not, series.
It is. You can't discount Nowitzki. You know, as you and I talked about last time, I think over the years – I've had a much more nuanced approach to the rest of the league. As much as I am a Heat fan, I still appreciate when
Nowitzki does. You're a Heat. You just said you're a Jordan guy growing up. Come on.
Growing up, that was one thing. Again, well, there wasn't much to root for here in Miami, bro. Come on.
You weren't a fan of Billy Owens and Harold Miner?
No. Billy Owens.
Sasnolovich, really? Come on.
Billy Owens was one of those players. What was he, 6'9"? He could dribble the ball. I mean, he was one of those guys. He was like a predecessor to, you know, guys like Chris Webber, who could do a little bit of everything. I love Billy Owens.
Yeah, but he was a disappointment in Miami, though. Anyway,
yeah, sure.
3-6. Okay, look, I have this series going 5, but I think every game will be competitive.
Yeah. You know, you can't discount Nowitzki. You can't discount, you know, what Rick Carlisle does there. I think Justin Anderson has been a pretty good player for them off the bench. I think he injects a little bit of youth and athleticism there. You know, I also got a chance to talk with him and with his high school coach, and he told me specifically that he was going to be able to get better over the course of the year because of Justin's incredible work ethic. And sure enough, he's been a factor for them of late and helped them get a couple of late season wins. So I think he's going to be an issue there, and I think he's going to want to make an impact in the playoffs. So you're right. I see it completely being a competitive series, even though it's probably a short-lived one. I've got OKC in 5 as well.
I think, okay, I'm really curious, OKC, how they approach the series, because I think they could be a spoiler in the Western Conference in terms of, you know, because everybody's guaranteeing penciling San Antonio and Golden State Western Conference Final. Oklahoma City can make things interesting here, but I think how they look in this, the perception of how they look in this series as Dallas will tell me a lot about how they approach San Antonio in the next round.
Yeah, I mean, I was a believer in Oklahoma City. I thought they were going to be able to gel a lot more quickly and a lot more effectively. That hasn't been the case. They just, the pieces they have are too one-dimensional.
Yeah.
And you know that I covered the team for the greatness that is Westbrook and Durant. The rest of their guys, even a guy like Ibaka, who's a very good third wheel, he's limited. He can't create offense. He's not always going to be a knockdown shooter, even though he's pretty good when he has the ball. But he doesn't initiate offense, and so he's limited. You know, Steven Adams is very good. You know, Enes Kanter is a good scorer off the bench. But the guys like Singler, Randy Foy, those guys haven't contributed much. So I'm not a believer anymore. I think Durant's gone. I think Oklahoma City season is over, and I think it's the end of an era in Oklahoma City.
Ooh, wait, you think Durant's gone this summer?
Yeah, I think he leaves.
I still think he's going to come back another year and then get on the same free agency track with Westbrook and Ibaka.
You're right. I see that. Look, I don't know. I don't know anything about it. I don't really have a dog in that race either. But to be honest with you, you know, I don't know that a guy like Durant can afford to waste another year. And I don't know that this team's going to be significantly better next
this
year.
This is something I think you and I should discuss on my main podcast this summer before free agency. Because I think this is a story that's gone under the radar again because of Golden State's greatness, Kobe's retirement, which we'll get to in a second, you know, of course, and San Antonio, all that. This Durant thing, you know, once the dust settles in the season, this will hit us in the face like nothing else.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, we had a much more vested interest in seeing what you know LeBron did in 2014 and in 2010, but I mean, this is the biggest story of the summer is what happens with Kevin Durant. It might be anticlimactic.
Wait, LeBron, what did LeBron do?
Oh, yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I know you're kidding.
What did that guy do? Why is he so important? All right. And the final matchup, of course. I'm looking forward to this matchup. Heavily looking forward to this matchup. 4-5. Clippers, Blazers. By the way, another right at the breast. Maybe right there, breast team in terms of coach of the year candidate. Terry Stotts in Portland, man.
Yeah.
I had this team winning no more than 23 games, 24 games this year.
Oh, yeah. You're in the majority, as was I. I mean, I hate to use the phrase, but I think there might be a little bit of an East Coast bias in that we haven't, especially those of us on the East, haven't seen what Portland's done. But just their overall record, the fact that they've been able to hang tough in the West, been as great as they have. I know they've had incredible unexpected production from CJ McCollum. But for Terry Stotts, again, for all the platitudes we want to give about Spoelstra and keeping that ship steered in the right direction, Stotts went through more, I think. You know, yeah. The team was torn apart. He took a new roster, kept him in there.
Lost four starters.
Yeah, I mean, great ones too. I mean, Robin Lopez, you know, Nick Batum, you know, great team, and LaMarcus Aldridge, of course. And for him to be able to get them into playoff contention, he can't understate what he did there. I know a lot of the Coach of the Year award is probably going to go to Steve Kerr. It might go to Greg Popovich for the incredible job he's done in San Antonio. But come on, to take a team that was disassembled, get them to play at a high level, and to have new pieces come in there and be productive and great and fit seamlessly. I mean, that's coaching. That is coaching. And I think that falls squarely on his shoulders and the staff he has assembled there. So I think they have a very good chance at being a very good team in the future. But I don't like their chances against the Clippers. I think, you know, the return of Blake is going to be a big factor there. I think they've got a good roster. Obviously, Chris Paul has played at an MVP level this year. I think I like their chances. I'll give Portland 2 wins at home.
I'm with you there, too.
Yeah, I think it's six. Yeah, that's about right.
I will say this, though. This is all hypothetical, obviously. This could be a series. If the Clippers lose, this is where they blow things up. Because it's already bad enough the way they lost to Houston last year, being out 3-1, having that big lead in game six, you know, to close out the series. And then everything imploded. Then you have the DeAndre stuff last summer, obviously. This could be a series. If Portland, for some reason, upsets the Clippers, this is where I think you can start looking at real possibilities of Chris Paul being on the block, Blake Griffin on the block, maybe even Doc Rivers' future is in question. I don't know. DeAndre Jordan, certainly. This is a series where Portland could really... I say that because I don't know if the Clippers have that in the back of their mind. I don't know their ceiling, because obviously Golden State and San Antonio made their ceiling limited, obviously. But if they lose this series, before you even get to the Warriors in second round of the playoffs, this could be where the Clippers really blow things up this summer.
I mean, the Clippers, I don't think anybody really thinks of them as a legitimate title contender this year. Not with San Antonio, Golden State playing at such a high level.
Yeah, but there's still that next tier team that should at least be challenging, at least, you know, at least a second round team. And if Portland, the Blazers, the rebuilding Blazers, and they had a good year, obviously, but they're no better than a one and done team in the playoffs.
But that wasn't good enough for Scott Brooks in Oklahoma City. Well, I mean, he still got canned.
That's different. The Scott Brooks thing is a whole different story.
But the issue then is, you know, who do you hold responsible? Do you hold Doc Rivers GM or Doc Rivers coach for the failings on the floor? Is it because he didn't assemble a good team or because he didn't coach
last year? Last year, I can tell you from my perspective on my podcast, I said Doc Rivers GM failed Doc Rivers coach. I was very vocal about that all year long.
Right.
You know, and now if they lose in the first round, ain't just Doc Rivers the GM anymore. Doc Rivers the coach and probably Chris Paul and probably Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan. I tell you what, I don't think it's going to happen. But this hypothetical and this kind of stirring the pot a little bit, because this is why we love the NBA, we love the storylines. If the Clippers were to lose to Portland, if Lillard goes crazy, I'm telling you, this will be the mark where two years in a row, this is where Steve Ballmer might have to bump the team up.
You know, maybe it's just me because I'm an NBA junkie, but there is no series on paper that doesn't sound incredible to me and is going to have me glued to the television. I've already told my family, you know, pretend I'm not here for the next 2 months because I'm just going to be absolutely useless. I think I'm just going to be trying to watch every game possible. All these series, all these matchups, all these great players in there. I'm sad to see Utah out of it for our good friend Haley Burns. But yes, at the same time, I think that, you know, it's a very, very good matchups all across the board there. I'm really excited about this playoff series.
I want to use it for two reasons. Number one, I picked them for the 8 seed, number one. Number two, I wanted them to beat Houston because I wanted Harden and Howard to suffer a little bit.
Yeah, but at the same time, having them go there and be obliterated in four games to Golden State, I think that's even better, I think.
No, because that's already expected.
Yeah, but still. I mean, it's still, for my own personal pleasure, seeing them get eviscerated, I think, is going to be a great thing. And I think it's gonna not just drive the nail in the coffin, but possibly set it on fire there. So we'll see what happens in Houston this offseason.
All right, before we go, I want your thoughts. Kobe Bryant officially retired on Wednesday.
Yeah.
I don't know if you watched the game against Utah.
I did.
Tonight. I mean, it was kind of incredible to watch that whole thing. Now, obviously, it was an ugly basketball game. Two really, really bad teams. Well, Utah's not a bad team, but the Lakers certainly are. 17-win team this year. What are your thoughts on Kobe Bryant and his legacy now moving forward? I already give my thoughts on Kobe, you know, all throughout the week on radio and all that stuff. What are your thoughts on Kobe Bryant and his career and now we're now at the end point?
I'll tell you, first about that game and that day in particular, I mean, what a time to be an NBA fan. For the 73-9 record to be set at the same time as Kobe, one of the greatest players in NBA history, to be playing his last game, for Steph to be setting the record, 402 three-pointers, so much going on, a truly historic night in NBA history, and I think it was a great time for all of us to watch. As far as Kobe is concerned, I don't think I can have an opinion about him other than when it's purely conflicted. I think part of it, for me, the largest part of it is more than just the kind of person he is as a player, but just the kind of person he is as a man away from the court. And the situation in Colorado has always left a bad taste in my mouth when it comes to being able to deal with Kobe's presence. I just, you know, that situation, there's no way around it. There's no way of looking at it positively. And for me, it's forever tarnished whatever legacy he has. As a player, he was ruthless, he was a bastard, he was mean-spirited, but he was also incredible. And that's another part of why I'm so conflicted when it comes to Kobe, because he was great to watch. The fact that he ended it on a bad note, perhaps with being a ball hog and falling apart due to injury, how could it be any less how could it be anything other than that for a guy like Kobe, who gave everything he had and was as tireless as worker as the league has ever had, and has reached incredible levels of success, both individual and as a team. He was an incredible player. And as much as I dislike him, watching that last game, I won't go so far as to say it was a little emotional, but it was a nice cap to a truly historic career. And I did appreciate the way that it ended with a 60-point outing. That was incredible. So it left me with a little bit slightly more positive interpretation of his overall career, one that for me is still conflicted because I can't appreciate the person he is off the court.
that game on Wednesday was a perfect analogy. And I know I said with the Heat in the Celtics game, you know, Wednesday, but it really was, in Kobe's case, you know, the 50 shots, okay, to get the 60 points. You know, the love fest and then the hatred on Twitter. You know, because Kobe Bryant, to me, is the most polarizing superstar, maybe not only NBA history, but probably in sports history, in terms of the peak where he's an all-time great. So in terms of where his stature is in the NBA and certainly around American sports, he's probably the most polarizing superstar in sports history. Because I said this for years, Dave. You can't be in the middle of Kobe Bryant. You either love Kobe Bryant or you hate Kobe Bryant. There's no, well, he's okay. Oh, I like him. He's okay. No. You love him or you hate him. And the thing for me is that I've been on both sides of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I came into 1997, 1998 with Kobe Bryant hating the guy. Because he was so cocky. And mind you, this is also 17, 18-year-old me who looked at that guy and said, wait, you're not Jordan yet. And I remember the 98 All-Star game.
Right, right.
Jordan's last All-Star game was a Bull. His last sixth ring that same year, where Jordan torched Kobe. I'm not a Jordan guy necessarily either myself, but I respected the guy, of course, you know. And Jordan torches Kobe in that game. And I remember taking a lot of pleasure in that because I actually taped the game on my VCR and watched it over and over again because I was like, yeah, Kobe, take that, Kobe, take that, Kobe, you know. And to me, Kobe, to me, seemed very too polished to me. And this is before Colorado, of course.
Sure. No, I know.
He was too polished, you know, and then Colorado happened. And I'm like, oh, yeah, great. You see, I told you he was a fake. It's like Tiger Woods to me. It was fake, you know. And then Kobe became himself. Kobe stopped pretending who he was.
Embrace the hate.
And that's why I started to respect him. Kobe embraced everybody hating him. My wife despises Kobe Bryant. Can't stand him because, and I told her, well, this is the reason why I like him, because for the same reason you don't like him is that, you know what, this is who he really is, and I'd rather you be who you are and be that way. And to me, that's why I've always said Kobe Bryant to me is more interesting than Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan was polished from start to finish.
Right.
We find about the Jordan stuff after the fact. When his playing days are over, about, well, some of us may have knew about it, right, but the majority of the people who worship Jordan from the outside didn't find out about Michael Jordan's, the infidelities and, the gambling stuff on a higher scale until after his playing days,
Well after.
Kobe Bryant, you were experiencing that through the process.
Yeah.
And because of Kobe Bryant's process and because of 1994 and then the Shaq thing happened, of course, and, he's on his own, that's where I started to appreciate Kobe Bryant as a player and as a person.
It's tough because, how much of that is the fact that his career took place during the social media era where people could dissect his game and talk about how much they love Kobe or hate Kobe versus the limited amount of time of ways of communicating that you had in the 80s and 90s when, Jordan was at his peak. Maybe we would have broken it down. Maybe there was a TMZ.com or another 24-hour news service at the point in time when Jordan was at his peak. Maybe they would have talked about his infidelities or the gambling issues or the fact that he was a royal prick to his teammates. I mean, those kinds of things, we didn't know about it until the Jordan rules came out in the early 90s. And obviously you and I at that point in time hadn't read the book, but that's what made a lot of noise at that time was, showing a different side than the polished image that Gatorade and Nike was trying to sell you. And I think that was the thing, is that, even as Jordan was this well-liked, attractive figure in the public eye, there was also a ruthlessness behind the scenes that we didn't know about, and that was where the conflict came into play. And then we saw that ruthless behavior on the court, but that was also part of what added to his overall mythology. That's what made him great, is that it's the fact that you knew going to the game what Jordan was going to do, and there was nothing you can do to stop it. And that's what made him such a powerful figure. And I think, we saw that from Kobe as well. Again, maybe tarnished a little bit, not just because of the incidents off the court, but also the fact that he was a little selfish, maybe more than a little, and the fact that he wasn't effective or the latter part of his career, but that he came in gunning and left the same way is a perfect, perfect full circle as far as his career.
Like I said, people were like all pissed off at the 60 shots, 50 shots rather, Kobe, he scored 60, but like, your comment is exactly, it makes this night perfect, because that's exactly what Kobe Bryant was. He was polarizing. There's either you love, 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 love Kobe Bryant, or is the stupid comment about 50 shots.
Right.
That's Kobe Bryant in a nutshell. So thank you for following the narrative, everybody. So once again, salute to Kobe Bryant, 20 years, first ballot Hall of Famer. He's a top 10 player. Top 10 player. We've had this discussion on my show, discussion in private. I think he's the second greatest Laker of all time behind Magic. Maybe third behind Jerry West, because I think Jerry West doesn't get a lot of credit for not only as a player, but also as a GM, building both Showtime and Kobe Shaq years. And I think he's... I gotta redo my rankings again, because it's been a couple years. I got Kobe between 6 and 9 in terms of where I rank him in terms of all-time greats.
It's tough, and I think you can't discount the last couple of seasons having, you know, maybe lowered him a little bit in those overall rankings. So maybe top 20.
Ooh, if
not
really?
Maybe top 20, if not necessarily top 10, top 20, just because of the way he ended on a poor note.
Okay. Makes sense. I get more offended when people start saying Kobe Bryant is a no more Laker of all time, no questions asked. I'll say it again. Magic Johnson's impact in 12 years bigger than Kobe's in 20, because Magic Johnson, I'll split numbers to you real quick. In 12 years of playing the Lakers, I don't even count 96, Fat Magic in 96, because that doesn't count. In 12 years, Magic Johnson won the 9 finals. 5 titles, and nine finals appearances and 5 titles in 12 years, okay? In the era, in the what I call the greatest era of basketball ever.
But was it though? I mean, you know, that's the whole thing. Is like you look at the fact that
arguably,
I mean, it's hard to say. Look, I love Magic. I love Magic's game. You know, I love the history of basketball, and I've watched him play over the years, and I know how great he is, but it's tough to say that. I mean, this is a conversation for another time probably, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly where he fits into that. I don't know if he's a top 10 guy either.
Whoa, Dave, we're going to have a fight. Where do you live at? We're going to have a fight right now, man. That's fisticuffs right there, brother. I'm a Magic guy. That's my ultimate favorite athlete. So
I know.
There's certainly a little bit of biasness coming from that, but Magic Johnson's – this is where I separate Magic from everybody else. And people say, why Magic? Because Magic Johnson, to me, is the greatest leader in sports history. Not just NBA history. He's the greatest leader in sports history.
All right. We're going to have to talk about this some other time, because we're going to get bogged down here. Because how you define leadership and what Johnson's actual impact as a leader was, I think that's vastly overstated. So that's going to be...
Whoa, Dave. Are we ending podcasts on this note? Okay, we got some. Okay, I think this summer we'll have to set up a podcast on my end and discuss this, because it's definitely something to discuss. But anyway, NBA playoffs. Like I said, Heat Hornets start on Sunday at 6:30 p.m. on TNT. David Mill, where can I find you, man?
At DRamill13. That's where I'll tweet all my work, but I also write for Hot Hoops occasionally, as well as Hardwood Paroxysm. Vice Sports, The Cauldron, Today's Fast Break.
Wait, you're on Vice now?
Yeah. I just had my first piece published there last week.
You don't tell me nothing anymore. I thought we were friends, man. Okay.
You're not following me on Twitter? I don't know what's going on there. I don't know what else to tell you.
Yeah, but I'm on Twitter as much anymore because I have a life.
Yeah. My life is all about basketball.
And right plus, now. Twitter's a cesspool, man. It really is.
It's difficult. I agree with you there.
Yeah. I have to, like, isolate your tweets now. Seriously, God, make me work with you more now that I have to.
I'm looking at it right now. The schedule, it's actually 5:30 p.m. Eastern on Sunday.
Okay, sorry about
not
that.
Not 6:30,
5:30 p.m. guys. Correction, I apologize.
And then again on Wednesday, so we've got a nice gap in between games. So hopefully we can
which helps Wade, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if we can, we have to win game one. We should have talked about that before. We have to win game one so that we build momentum into game two, and I think that'll make a huge difference.
You can follow me on Twitter at EJChristian7. You can follow my other podcast, the Earnestly Speaking Podcast, which airs at least 2-3 times a week. My blog at earnestlyspeaking.co, which is part of the NGSESports.com family. And I think we are done here. For me, for Dave Ramil, I'm Ernest Christian, and we'll see you probably next week with another podcast.